Hi folks, it's your host Harmit, and you're listening to Tobin Talks.
So what is your role with the John Howard Society?
I'm the literacy instructor in the literacy department at the John Howard Society of Manitoba.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so tell me a bit about this Get the Story Out program.
Sure. So this is a program that was started about 15 years ago inspired by a program also run by the Elizabeth Fry Society, which is kind of our associated societies.
Mm-hmm.
So Get the Story Out. Sorry, I'm a little dazed here. So we volunteers and staff at John Howard bring in children's books to institutions and get incarcerated people to read stories to their kids. And then we take those recordings, and my partner Christine Fellows sound designs and scores them. And then we wrap up the books, gift wrap the books, and send the books with the recording to the child so they can read along with their parent or loved one who's incarcerated.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So how many incarcerated people have been able to participate in this so far?
It's a very good question that I don't know the answer to, but over 15 years, I'm going to say hundreds.
Okay. So, like, I assume this is a project that relies on, like, public donations. So how can people chip in if they wish to do so?
Sure. You can go to the John Howard Society of Manitoba webpage, and there's a donation page there. You can donate to the literacy program. Or you can currently, until September 15th, go to McNally Robinson in Grant Park, and there's a table of selected books that you can purchase for the program. So you can go in and buy a book, choose a book from the list, and buy it for one of the kids, and then we'll use it in the program. And they also have a website, a page on their website that you can go to as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just search Get the Story Out, McNally Robinson. Yeah.
So, like, in your Rupert's Land news article about prison abolition in the Quaker tradition, you cited a passage from minute 93 of the 1981 Canadian Yearly Meeting. Mm-hmm. The prison system is both a cause and a result of violence and social injustice. Throughout history, the majority of prisoners have been the powerless and the oppressed. I was wondering if you could speak to that as it relates to this initiative and to your own work as a literacy instructor at John Howard Society.
Certainly. So I think that minute really, really leads me in my work. And I think this program is a great example of why we need to maintain connections between incarcerated people and their families. I think that it's a feature of the system, not a kink or not a
mm-hmm.
not a
bug,
not a bug, that it separates families and communities. So I think that it's an often overlooked aspect of incarceration that
mm-hmm.
really acts and disrupts and destroys relationships and entire communities, and especially families. And so the plight, I think, of incarcerated children really kind of highlights the whole network and web of injustices that happen when we incarcerate someone. I think that it does, that this program does relate to kind of my understanding of my of that Quaker Minute.
Yeah. So yeah, like, yeah, what you were saying there is like the separation, it being a feature of the system, like it's a rather than a bug, because storytelling is such a fundamental part of the human experience, if you want to call it that, and yet it's not something that I would necessarily think of as being deprived from people in prisons. Or their family, so I'm really glad that someone out there had thought of this. What has the response to this initiative been from the community and from the people involved who are working on it?
Really good, yeah. I think that it's really helpful. I think to maintain those connections, and we've heard from families that it's meant something to them. And I think that it's really good for the incarcerated people, because I think, one of the fundamental things of being a human is giving a gift to another human. And I think that that's something that we forget. Incarcerated people are denied. It's really hard for them to give a gift to someone. And mm-hmm. that's kind of a fundamental part of being a human. So I think, and especially to their children or kids they care about, or kids they're, yeah. So I feel like that's an important thing this program does, is allow them to get something.
Mm-hmm.
Huge thing too, right? Because there's no, I think people also forget that there's absolutely no internet in Canadian jails and prisons. So, there's no way of them to do what we're doing right now,
mm-hmm.
and to speak to one another on the phone is costly. There's always someone making money off of that.
Yeah.
So the idea that Canadian, we have this, I think, idealized image of Canadian prisons as being non-privatized, but mm-hmm. they are.
Yeah.
Within those things that certainly makes money off of incarcerated people. So, yeah, it's a huge challenge. Just the communication with the outside world is a massive kind of thing, hurdle for every incarcerated person. Yeah.
Yeah, and like that, your answer sort of got into one of my next questions, which was like, are there any public misconceptions about the carceral system or incarcerated people that you would like to address or clear up?
Right. I think that's the main one, right? Is that that it's very difficult to communicate with the outside world, and there's really a real resistance to like a structural resistance to allowing that. So that attacks the relationships of and erodes relationships,
yeah.
with family and community. So it's a real struggle, and so that's certainly a misconception. I think that people assume that there's some sort of internet in there, and
yeah.
There is not. So that's the other thing. And that, as a literacy instructor, that also I keep running into the limitations of that fact, right? In the last sort of 15 years, every university correspondence course has gone online.
Yeah.
So there's almost no correspondence courses, which is something that incarcerated people used to be able to do. So the fact is that as the world becomes more connected, the lives of incarcerated people become less so. So it's really a real puzzle, and a real kind of something I think that we don't consider as a public and as a society, that yeah. That our kind of adversarial and retributive justice system, just how adversarial and retributive it is, just by the fact of it. Yeah.
So I guess just my last question here is a bit of a big one, and it's one that I think about a fair bit. But what would it take for us collectively to build a world without police or prisons?
That's such a good question. And I love that question. I think what it takes, first off, is imagination and creativity. So I think we have to envision that as a world-building project, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we have to be creative and envision it, first off. And then we have to make interjections and interventions where we can. And I think maintaining the connections between incarcerated people and their families, for example, is always a good thing, is always a productive thing.
Mm-hmm.
We can find kind of small acts that will build towards our better world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in the meantime, also just I think it's really important that people try and reach out to incarcerated people to let them know that that they're human beings, and that we just to let them know that I think reaching out and trying to understand what their lives are like is a great first step.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. You've given me a lot to think about and to write about. Thank you so much for this.
I go by Jenny Newton Montgomery now, and my pronouns are she and her, and I'm a professor in the psychology department and also the coordinator of the school psychology program.
Awesome. Thank you. So the first question I have is, why did you choose to go into your line of research?
First of all, why I went into the area I study, and part of that is it's an opportunity for me to talk to you about an area nobody knows about. So first of all, I became a school psychologist, or I went into training as a school psychologist, because I was a classroom teacher prior to that. I taught kindergarten and I taught resource room, where kids were mostly struggling to learn to read. And I had the opportunity to work with a school psychologist in the school division I worked for. And one thing I learned was that I could, that school psychologists could really target areas of processing difficulties and figure out how kids learn. So I wanted to be able to do that. So I went into school psychology. And actually, I took a different path than I thought I would. So I went to grad school thinking, I'm going to be a school psychologist, and I'm going to help kids with reading disabilities. In my training program, there was clinical work that we had to do. And for some reason, I kept working with kids on the autism spectrum. It was a random assignment. It just happened. And as I worked with these kids, I noticed that despite the many challenges that they had remarkable, but often unnoticed areas of strength. And so, you know, as a former teacher, that was very meaningful for me, in terms of, you know, understanding that we can do things to help them show their strengths and even compensate for areas that are more difficult for them. And so I often say to people, I didn't pick autism as a research and clinical area. It picked me. And it was a matter of the people I worked with were so phenomenal and really just touched my heart. And so that's kind of how I ended up in the research area. You know, like clinical psychology, school psychology, we have practice areas and we have research areas. And mine happened to both be in the autism spectrum.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that. The next question I had is, could you please tell me about your past and present work and the importance of it?
So I run the social cognition lab in the psychology department at the University of Manitoba. And so social cognition is basically a science-based approach to understanding how people understand their own emotions and how they understand others' emotions and how they work through social situations in everyday life with that information. I work with a lot of people with autism because social cognition or social thinking is often difficult for people on the spectrum. And so that's kind of where the autism work comes in. It's a broader lab. We sometimes have projects that don't have anything to do with autism, but the majority of our projects certainly reflect autism. So why is it important? I think there's another piece here. So one of the main areas I research is something called emotional intelligence. Again, it's a science-based approach that I use. There are non-science-based approaches to emotional intelligence. I use the one that is more supported by science. And while it's important for everybody, people on the spectrum in particular have difficulty in that area. And when you look at the criteria for autism diagnosis, it actually seems very similar to what we talk about when we say people have good emotional intelligence skills, except in the opposite way. Inversely related, right? So that's where they struggle. So to me, that seemed like a really good model for studying emotional intelligence and also maybe making a meaningful impact on people who struggle with emotions. I first use that concept in my clinical work to identify areas and strategies that we could use to improve the social interactions of people on the autism spectrum. And later on, I saw some research potentials there, and particularly related to enhancing quality of life for people on the autism spectrum. So that's kind of one area, and it's to me the meaning there is that hopefully our research points to some areas where we can make, a real difference in the everyday lives of people on the spectrum. So certainly that's kind of where most of my work goes. My earlier work, I'll leave that for now. I later developed an interest in testing the development of emotional intelligence in autism. And I worked with some colleagues from Calgary. They did some studies on their own and related to my work to look at what's happening across the lifespan in emotional intelligence. So there's two kinds of emotional intelligence that are research-based. One is ability. How do you do in your everyday interactions? Can you solve problems? Those sorts of things. And the other one is, what characteristics do you have that facilitate solving those problems? So it's things like stress management, optimism, flexibility, all sorts of things like that. And so what we discovered was that there are differences across the lifespan. And actually, the kids we work with autism, who tend to be what they used to call high functioning, autism without an intellectual disability, that they do just as well as kids without autism in early childhood. When it comes to older kids, and we studied kids from ages 13 to 17, we found that they had difficulties with both forms. So both, the characteristics and the using it in everyday practice. And then my doctoral work actually was on young adults. So teens, 17 to 21 is what we looked at. And what we found there was that the ability form, kind of the performing of emotional intelligence, was much better and comparable to other people. Whereas that trait form that we talk about, those characteristics were still underdeveloped compared to people who didn't have autism. And so that's actually led me into another area of research, which is interventions with autism using emotional intelligence. And so a lot of what we're doing now, not everything in our lab, but a lot of what we're doing is looking at that. And part of that is because research shows that you can build emotional intelligence in everyone, not just people on the autism spectrum. And so we've been doing intervention studies where we design programs that teach people about emotional intelligence, offer them an opportunity to talk about their emotions, offer them, you know, social norms and social rules that will help them in those situations. And our findings so far, they're pretty preliminary, but our findings are that we're making a difference, not only in the emotional intelligence, but in quality of life overall. So people say they're happier, they have more friends, they're able to process work situations that are social better. And so that's kind of, in terms of meaning, that's another area. I do have other areas of research. I know you can't write a lot, but if you're interested, one of the other areas that we're reinvigorating in our lab right now, and also was part of our early work, is understanding psychological tests and how they work for people with autism. So not all tests work the same for every population, and so a lot of our work is testing the tests. So that's another aspect that we're working with. But ultimately, emotional intelligence has been the theme that's run through most of my work. So I probably jumped in and answered some of your other questions there. But,
awesome. Yeah. Okay, well, are there any specific projects that you feel may be interesting to highlight in the article?
Well, and I think really what I was talking about with the interventions is probably what people would find interesting. So we received my tax funding, and we worked with two nonprofit organizations to modify and reinvigorate a previous intervention program that I developed and make it more contemporary, you know, make sure that the program that we developed 10 to 15 years ago still fit the norms today. And so there were a lot of changes in it. But yes, so I think that is the most interesting, you know, the idea that we can improve outcomes for people on the spectrum, that, you know, most of them seem happier when they've learned more about not only their own emotions, but how to interpret people without autism and how they process emotions. And so, yeah, I think that's probably the one most worth highlighting.
Sounds good.
We're also involved in a number of measurement projects as well. And so that's the testing the test. We are beginning to work with international collaborators testing tests of autism symptoms that don't quite meet the full criteria internationally. So that's primarily in Spain, but we're also involved in other countries, and we're going to be the Canadian population in those studies. So that's ongoing, and I suspect a lot of our future work will be looking at that to see how those things work. And so I can highlight just a quick recent study. My doctoral student defended yesterday. And so she tested one test of something called the broad autism phenotype. It's for people who don't meet the full threshold symptoms to get a diagnosis, and often is present in family members of people who have autism. And what we found is that there were several items on this very popular test that don't work really well. And so we're suggesting modifications to that. And so that's how a lot of that measurement works, is that we recommend changes that might make things a better tool.
Okay, sounds good. So what is your ultimate goal as a researcher?
Well, that's a good question. It changes from time to time. but I think the general thing, you know, as someone who came from a practical field working with kids and teens, I want my research to be something that's meaningful. Sometimes researchers, sometimes our studies are not obviously relevant to the general population. And so I want my work to be relevant to people with autism. And so as a result, the way that I do my research is I include people with autism on my teams. I check with the autism community at all stages of research to ensure that what we're doing is important to them, and also in how we share information. So we ask them, you know, things like, would you prefer a fact sheet? Should I put it on my website? How would you like a workshop? Those sorts of things. And so I think that that's the way that I make sure that it's meaningful. But I would say my overarching goal is to ensure that what we do makes a difference.
Okay, fantastic. So that was it for my questions. Is there anything else that you wanted to add in?
I'm going to take this opportunity because this, I don't know if you can tell, but people with autism are near and dear to my heart. And as I said, you know, often their challenges overshadow their strengths. And so I think what I would like to say to the university community, and autism is highly prevalent, and it's very likely that everyone has met somebody on the autism spectrum. And I think because of that, you want to keep in light that while they may approach tasks in different ways, unique ways, really, they often are highly skilled in other areas. Yet social demands are very challenging for them. So I think if you want to understand how to improve your relationships or even your teaching, I highly recommend that we ask people on the spectrum what works best for them. Every person on the spectrum is unique. That's why it's called a spectrum, because everyone is so diverse. And so, you know, I think we need to try not to enforce traditional learning approaches, support safe and accepting spaces, and appreciate individual strengths. And I think that's really important, because what we know about people on the autism that there is autism spectrum is there are many innovators out there who happen to have autism. And they can be innovators when we ensure that our attitudes and our environments don't get in their way.
Well, folks, that's everything for today's Tobin Talks episode. If you have any questions, concerns, or suggestions, please feel free to email me at audio@themanitoban.com. You can listen to Tobin Talks anytime on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, you name it, and you can pick up a copy of The Manitoban from stands all throughout campus.
Tune in on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. to be the first to hear new Tobin Talks episodes.
Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you then.